Hi everyone, welcome back to Boba Talk, where we deconstruct the history of the Pacific War one boba at a time. So we love making the past relevant, and we hope to do so in today's discussion on reparations. But first, let's just talk about ourselves for a little.
Yes. Hello everyone, it's Hannah, if you don't remember me, because I say that every episode, just in case you forgot.
And this is Naomi.
And we're so excited to have a conversation with you guys today. Last week, we had a great conversation about the Vietnamese boat people with our two special guests, Sam and Sam.
If y'all haven't seen or heard it, actually, it's a podcast. So if you haven't heard it, it's the episode right before this one, episode 3, Vietnamese boat people and immigration stories.
And I think we both walked away from that conversation feeling like we both learned and expressed a lot. And I think it's one of my personally favorite episodes that we've done.
Yeah, so today we're going to do reparations, or the lack thereof of reparations. We're going to kind of talk about the influence that they have even years after conflict and war. And we'll talk about what it's like to commemorate and remember history and how we should be navigating these discussions. So for today's episode, we're first going to do a deep dive, of course. We'll talk about apology for war, but there is so much material to cover that we cannot cover it within like an hour span.
Right.
So please check out our website, pacificatrocities.org, for more information. We're also just going to have a conversation surrounding the influence of reparations and thinking about how we need to do better and which countries we should maybe look to as role models. And to end, of course, we'll always just talk about some Bay Area community news, but also some global news. So I'm going to hand it off to Hannah to do our deep dive.
So reparations, we hear that term all the time in the news, but who knows what it actually means? So reparations, according to Google, is that when one party commits a crime or does something against another group of people, it is a way of apologizing through a monetary way. And so what you see in the real world are governments paying a group of people that they had victimized or committed an atrocity against in the past. And the most popular example we can give is the German government paying survivors of the Holocaust reparations afterwards. But another example that you might not be aware of is the United States. I know, the United States actually did reparations. The United States pays Japanese Americans who were interned during World War II under the Civil Liberties Act of 1988. So to jog your memory, after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, President Roosevelt issued an order that interned all Japanese Americans or Americans of Japanese descent into internment camps. And that was a really bad decision. And so to say sorry for that, the U.S. government, you know, 40 plus years later, paid the surviving internee $20,000. And that was in the 80s, so it's a lot more now. And so some interesting points about the terms of reparations is that it included a formal apology from the U.S. government to Japanese Americans. They, you know, said that it was an injustice, and they created a public fund to dedicate educating American citizens on the event. And, you know, just a side note, before I became a history major and started working at this nonprofit, the only real part about the Pacific Asia War that I knew of was the internment of Japanese Americans and Pearl Harbor. So there you go. So this was a great thing that I think the U.S. government did. But what else kind of lingers in my mind when we talk about reparations and we talk about World War II is the actual country of Japan, not Japanese Americans. Yep. So what would happen maybe if Japan did the same thing to survivors of the Korean and Chinese and Japanese comfort women stations? Or if the U.S. just did this for descendants of African slaves? So reparations are a controversial topic because it usually means that a government is taking responsibility for a crime which they committed. And that also normally means admitting that a crime happened. Or not a crime, but an atrocity. So let's talk about the Japanese government and the debate of reparations. So first of all, did the Japanese commit crimes or war crimes during the Second World War against a group of people? Now, the answer to this, we're going to say, is yes. So it is estimated that between 1937 and 1945, the Japanese military murdered nearly 3 to 10 million people, about 6 million Chinese, Taiwanese, and Singaporeans, Malaysians, Indonesians, Koreans, Filipinos, and Indochinese, among others. And that also includes Western prisoners of war as well. You also have incidents like the Rape of Nanking that happened before the formal Pacific Asia War that we can talk about. Now, many people will say, okay, well, those were handled in the Tokyo trials. And Tokyo trials were a war crimes trial that took place after the Second World War, but only 28 Japanese military leaders were indicted, and they were indicted for crimes against humanity and peace. Now, this trial has been widely criticized on both sides. Many believe that this trial was sort of a trial for the victors of history to say, yes, the Japanese killed many people, but so did people in the Allies as well. And, you know, because there were very few Asian American judges appointed at this time, and because this trial created a new legal precedent, things like crimes against peace and crimes against humanity weren't a thing before then, people were like, hey, you're kind of making this up just to put these people in jail. But then there are other people who said, this didn't go far enough. This trial did not go far enough. No heads of the military police who committed many of the atrocities were indicted. There we go. And most importantly, there has yet to be a formal apology from the Japanese government about the Rape of Nanking or many of the comfort women stations that were created during the Second World War. So I like to think of this as sort of a like apology, your words versus your action. Mm-hmm. So there's been a lack of apology from the Japanese government, but also their actions following the Second World War don't really demonstrate that they are very sorry for what happened. There's been a huge lack of education surrounding the Pacific War and the atrocities that the Japanese committed in Japanese schools. So many Japanese grow up and they don't really know about things like the Rape of Nanking or comfort women, and they don't really understand the trauma that people have experienced. So now we're going to open it up to discussion. Do you think the Japanese should pay reparations to the victims of the Second World War? And if so, why?
Oof, oh my gosh. That's heavy and that's a big debate like we just talked about, but I think like it's a big deal because one, like not only, like you said, it's your actions against your word. So it's kind of like as much action as you can do, it's still like a formal apology is a formal apology. And it's so important to recognize what you did, even like, even how you apologize. Like you mm-hmm. can apologize by being very like biased and being very like, oh, like we're sorry for this, but like you should understand we didn't actually do this. Like there are certain ways you apologize where you need to take responsibility, and that's a whole nother thing we can talk about, is like who do you hold accountable for these atrocities? Like do you hold the people that committed them like directly? Do you hold the leaders? Right. Do you hold the whole country, or do you hold the government? So it's like it's very tricky to dance between those lines, but I think like as a government or as a country, like as a whole, that's kind of the responsibility of a country.
Yeah. And I think we've talked a lot on this podcast about intergenerational trauma. Mm-hmm. And I think a government coming forward and apologizing could help prevent that trauma from being passed down. If the victims had some sort of closure or understanding, then that can help them let go. Because you see all this comfort women activism happening from women who are now in their 90s. Mm-hmm. They've never been able to get over what happened to them because a government still denies that they ever committed a crime yeah. against them.
Yeah, and it still baffles me how countries can't handle it or can't wrap their minds around it, because how do you put a dollar amount on the effect yeah. that you've, the influence that you've had and the impact you've had on all of these families and all of these like victims, the country as a whole, but also the generations that follow, mm-hmm. Including like the trauma, but also just you set all these generations back so fast within one action. So how yeah. do you put like a dollar amount on it? Like how do you put worth mm-hmm. connected to trauma?
Yeah, it's like how do you quantify someone's like someone's experience. You know, no amount of money is ever going to take that experience away from them, because most of the time it defines their entire life. Something else I always think of is I always compare reparation cases to what happened in Germany. You know, Germany kind of seems to be like the pivotal example of like what to do, where to look to as an example of a country that really did reparations in the right way. You know, they had a huge trial after the Second World War, but then, you know, Germans today, they're still a large part of their elementary education is about what happened in the Holocaust. And so I think that's an example as to how reparations don't just have to be monetary. You can sort of dedicate a whole like educational aspect to talking about these issues, talking about what, why it was a crime and why it was wrong.
Yeah, because just because something has ended years ago or conflict has diminished, it doesn't invalidate and it doesn't make these stories disappear, because it will always be in history, and history does a great deal of remembering and like memorializing these histories. But we're also thinking like, okay, like if there's this education, like there's also, how do you educate the public on this? Like, do you start when they're young? Do you educate through a lot of, there's education through like a monument. Like you can build a monument or a statue and have like the dates written on there, but is that enough? Is that just commemorating without educating?
Right.
So it's like, how do you tiptoe around that? And like, why is it important to educate our youth about it? Because especially we know like the terms of history where you do what, or you learn history to avoid the future like circumstances of having to redo and recap history.
Yeah.
So it's like you're teaching all these students, and nationally or like throughout the world, you need to teach students about the consequences of war and the consequences of conflict and why it's important that we commemorate, but not just like pass it off as, oh, this is something that happened years ago.
Yeah. And I understand the idea of a victor's history.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the United States committed some actions that weren't great during the war either.
You don't love it.
You know, but bad things happen on either side, and there is a certain amount of truth where whichever side loses gets investigated and punished more thoroughly than the winning side. So I do think there's a slight argument in that, but there's a lot of evidence about the atrocities that were committed in the Pacific War, and the fact that this is still an issue that the Japanese government are sort of avoiding is very... it's very sad. It's it's disappointing.
Yeah, and there are people in Japan that want, like, people that have, are descendants from those that committed these crimes that want this to be recognized and want it to be memorialized. Even if they aren't necessarily the victims, they also believe that it's just as important to talk about the wrongdoings that a country has done.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like, how will you move forward in a country's, like, governance and stuff if you don't understand what you've done wrong and you don't understand what other countries feel about you? That kind of just ruins like international relations as a whole.
And like, you just saying that statement just makes me be so ashamed of like the U.S.'s handling over reparations about slavery too. So, you know, like, how can a government continue and persist without recognizing things that they've done wrong? Not also to mention the Trail of Tears. And many people believe that the treatment of Native Americans in the U.S. is genocidal. So, you know, the U.S. has this surprising history of paying reparations for Japanese Americans. And that was controversial at the time. But I also think there are other groups of people who also need to be recognized, and a formal apology needs to be made from the U.S.
Yeah. And even, like, on, like, I'm trying to think, like, smaller scale, because we're thinking all this big scale, like, global, we're thinking, like, all these countries, but even on a smaller scale, like, how individuals are exonerated, and thinking about who's exonerated, like, I kind of just, like, there's been this discussion about our president and how he gets away with it because he's the president, but just because you hold leadership or you hold a role in society, I don't think that automatically exonerates you, especially from even investigation. Like, you can get away without even being investigated.
I mean, power dynamics, you see them everywhere, even in, like, the workplace and things like that. So it's interesting to see, like, okay, like, who gets away with things is a very interesting story. It's almost a way to expand sort of the discussion of reparations to power dynamics in the workplace.
There are a lot of powers at place.
And then something else I want to mention is a lot of people are concerned. There's a tremendous amount of activism happening in Japan, Korea, and China with the survivors of Comfort Women who are advocating for an official apology from the Japanese government. Many people are afraid this generation of women are going to die out soon because, you know, they are in their 90s.
Yeah, there's not that many left of them.
And so it's like, does the discussion of reparations, does it become eliminated when the generation of people who have been victimized, they die out? Because a lot of people make that argument in the U.S. to avoid reparations against slavery. They say, oh, it was over, you know, 200 years ago, and the descent and people who were slaves are now dead. But many people are like, you know, you should pay for the descendants of slaves. As well. So what do you think about that?
That's crazy. Like we talked about how these conflicts and these wars don't just affect the victims. They affect the generations that follow, and even the governing like systems itself. They are affected. International relations are affected for years on end. But even just like the fight for it, like if there's a fight for it, it shows how important it is, you know? And obviously, like, there has been, like, discussion and there has been debate for years. But I think, like, as a victim and as, like, the family of a victim, it's just as important because you carry that legacy and you carry that blood and history. So personally, for me, like, if I was to give out reparations, I would have to, give reparations to the correct people. But at the same time, like, understand that there are a lot of families affected and the whole country can be affected. So it is very tricky. Like, how much do you give? And, like, your apology, I think the apology itself is the most important part. Like, money does rule the world. But I think apologizing and recognizing that is very important. It's not just you throw out a dollar amount and you back out. You have to, like, recognize what you did. And you have to recognize that it has consequences for more than just the day it happened.
Yeah, and I thought it was so powerful reading the Declaration for Reparations for Japanese Americans because, you know, they admitted that it was an injustice.
Yeah.
And then they committed to educating future Americans on what happened.
Education, I feel like, is the most important part.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like there'd be a huge positive response if the U.S. did that for other groups that they have victimized in the past and are, you know, continuing to victimize.
Yeah, and, like, educating doesn't mean that, like, in your history books, you don't have to be sappy and go, oh, yeah, we did this wrong, blah, blah, blah. You don't have to do it in a sense that victimizes or puts one person against another. It's not a them versus us thing, but it is a fact that you educate to bring awareness. You're not educating to kind of, like, push one down or, like, there's, you don't put it on a pedestal. Don't do it. You have certain intentions is what I mean. So it's like how you educate and, like, your intentions to educate is very important.
Yeah, exactly. It's like saying you're sorry and then trying to make a promise to educate is almost like trying to create a clean slate and actually move forward from a wrongdoing and create a positive start. And so I think that was a really hopeful message that I just hope in the future can be applied to other, you know, wrongdoings that have happened to people in the U.S. Under U.S. leadership and in Japan as well.
And I think it's really important, of course, like, strengthen numbers because we're in the Bay Area and that's our saying, but also strengthen numbers and how we fight for our reparations and, like, how we fight for commemoration. So, like, one example I can bring up is, like, the Wednesday demonstration in Korea. But that's very important because it started so long ago, but it's still going on every single week. They've only missed twice, I think, and one was because of a tsunami, so out of respect they didn't do their demonstrations
after the earthquake.
So I'm just gonna give a little bit of context then.
So
the Wednesday demonstrations were demanding Japan to redress the Comfort Women problems, and it is a weekly protest in Korea which aims to obtain justice from the Japanese government. So these happened every single week, and so many people show up still. After, I think, it, when did it? 1992 was the first year they did it. So after that, like, there's still so many people showing up, and it shows the persistence and it shows the drive that people want to educate themselves and want to educate others on the atrocities and the crimes that were committed and how important it is that they want reparations. So stuff like that, like, that brings it to attention, and I wish that, like, the Japanese government and that Japan itself would recognize the hard work that people are putting in to look for reparations. And I think, like, that's recognizable in itself.
Absolutely. Wow. Well, I think that kind of sums up our discussion. So I hope that you kind of that got you thinking about what reparations are, why they should be applied to certain issues of history, and also just connect to how history continues to live through us. Whether you're interested or know a lot about history or not, you still represent mm-hmm. something that happened in the past, and we're still a product yeah. of our past.
And I want to kind of just, for all our like listeners, is like to bring with you is just to... a message I would take away from this is to just like stay knowledgeable and mm-hmm. keep learning and keep educating yourself if nobody else is, because it is very important to understand what happened in the past, and mm-hmm. it is very hard to learn from other people because there is always inherent bias and there's always different sides telling you different things. So I think educate yourself and learn for yourself and seek information when you can, because it is crucial to how we move forward as a society.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. So Naomi is going to give us some brief headlines of
yes.
things that are happening in the Bay.
So, well, actually I'm going to first start with something happening internationally. Sorry, Hannah.
Okay.
This just happened today, and this is kind of crazy, but Beijing just banned solo travel to Taiwan because of the cross-strait tensions that have been happening the last few weeks. So what's happening is that they just announced this morning that they're going to suspend a program that has allowed tourists from 47 different cities to visit Taiwan. And in the statement, they have stated that it's effectively banning only individual leisure travel, but you can travel as a business initiative. But this is a big deal because prior to this banning, there's actually mm-hmm. been a lot of stuff going on in the last 2 weeks about just like the tensions between China and Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
You can definitely read more. It's all over the news right now, but I want to give a little bit more information for folks that haven't heard about the tensions. So from what I have gathered, last Wednesday, China took an aim at what considers a pro-independence or separatist forces in the far west region of Xinjiang, Tibet, and Taiwan. And in this white paper that was released, there were a lot of accusations. There was a lot of pointing and a lot of division between Taiwan. I combined it, but China and Taiwan. And this paper, the biggest thing that people are taking away from it is that it accused Taiwan's government of pursuing a path of separatism by pushing for independence and warning that China must and will be reunited. So that's a hefty,
threatening
statement to make. So because of this, there's a lot of just like Beijing against Taiwan against Beijing, and there's a lot of subtle but also not very subtle attempts at maybe like reunification, but also wanting to divide because yeah. there's so much conflict.
I mean, reunification definitely feels like a euphemism in this
example
for like, you know, invasion or war or forced reunification. So it's definitely troubling news, I would say. Mm.
And I think this ban, especially like with Beijing to Taiwan, like that's a big ban.
Mm-hmm.
You're banning from 47 different cities. That's a lot of cities. and it does, like they said in the previous papers, that they don't want to intensify any hostility. But I think that just intensified it a lot more. And I don't think that there's a good way to go about it.
Yeah. And it's not just Taiwan that they're targeting, but Tibet and Xinjiang, which are like two other areas that have been sort of not separatist, but just had a different sort of history and different mm-hmm. culture and different mm-hmm. maybe philosophy on how they should be ruled. So it'll be very interesting. It just seems like China is trying very hard to sort of reinstill its power over these provinces. Yeah.
Also, something crazy is that Taiwan's government under their president, I also read in the white paper that they want to intensify hostility and confrontation by borrowing the strength of foreign influence.
Mm.
So it's like, interesting.
What foreign influence?
Yeah. So I want to see what happens next. I want to know like who they're going to borrow from and what strength or what capability do yeah. these influences have and what they're trying to do next. Because this ban itself is kind of small enough for them to say, oh, we're not cutting it off like all the way, but they're also, it's big enough to tell you that, oh, it's a big deal that's going on within Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
But we're gonna move on from that. That is very complicated, it's very complex, and I'm sure there's gonna be more news by the time we film our next episode.
Oh gosh, probably tomorrow.
Yeah. So moving on, I guess this is more local. This is from Sacramento. So there's a 100-year-old company that's going to be the first U.S. business to ever export rice to China.
There you go.
Yep. So in July 2019, the Sun Valley Rice, it's a family-owned company. They're based in Sacramento, California.
Whoop whoop.
Yep, they signed a contract with a Chinese importer and they made themselves the first U.S. rice producer to sell rice to China.
Trade war who?
So what I've seen from this article is that China's been very tough to get into because for so many years it's been illegal to just sell rice over there. And a lot of this comes from like the different regions that are in China, but also like there's Japan and Korea. So in 2018, the US and China came to an agreement that made it legal to export American rice to China.
Wow.
And as a result, this is crazy, more than two dozen US companies were approved to finally export rice to China, but Sun Valley was the first to land a real deal.
Wow.
There you go.
That's wild. I love rice, and so I'm happy that everyone is able to try Sacramento rice now because I'm sure it's great.
Yeah. So what I've also read, which I didn't even know this, but this is pretty interesting to talk about, is that California's rice growing regions are at the same latitude as Korea and Japan.
Should not
So
know
that's how
that.
big it was. I did not know that. So what they've said from Sun Valley is that they all grow the same type of rice, medium grain and short grain. That's what's popular in Chinese, Japanese, and Korean cuisine. So why not step forward and bank on it?
Yeah, I mean, California is a very geographically diverse, almost said country, state.
Oh, if
Oh.
California was its own country, hit us up.
Yeah. So, I definitely believe that they have the same latitude regions as Korea and
Oh yeah,
Japan.
for sure. And California, a lot of people undermine its agriculture because a lot of times when you think about US agriculture, you think of like the Midwest and like the farms that are in the backcountry roads. But California is a big agriculture
Big
center,
agriculture
and we
center.
export a lot because we're by the coast. We are the coast.
We are the
We
coast.
are all the coast. West Coast is the best coast. Moving on, this one's really cool, and I'm excited to talk about this one. So I just saw that San Francisco has beat New York as the number one city for female founders.
Yes.
Finally. So this is the first time that San Francisco has topped New York as the number one city because this is all founded on like long there's different like indexes and different
Statistics to measure
statistics,
this
but
stuff.
this one came from the Launching, Growing, and Scaling Companies according to 2019 Women Entrepreneur Cities Index.
Wow.
That was a crazy one. So the Bay Area ranks first for capital and tech, which of course we have the Silicon Valley. Like, of course we're great
We
at
have a lot of
tech.
thoughts about
Yeah,
that.
we can talk about that more. I've written a whole essay on it. We also have second for marketing culture, but we're also ninth for talent.
Only ninth.
So in comparison, New York ranks first for marketing culture, second for capital, fourth for technology, and seventh for
What's number one for
talent.
talent, LA?
Probably.
Huh.
They got a lot of entertainment over there.
Interesting.
Yeah. Or it's a random, like Seattle, maybe. I don't know. When it comes to venture capital, though, the Bay Area is the undisputed powerhouse, and it's tops for female founders in terms of venture capital, dollar raised, number of deals, and gender proportion.
Wow.
So both the Bay Area and New York show strength in dollars raised on crowdfunding sites. But New York kind of beat us out because their index number of deals triples Bay Area's.
Oh, I wish I knew what that
But this is very monumental because I think we're kind of finally in a stage where our fragile American society can talk about the gender relations when it comes to work and industries.
Yes.
Because for the longest time, we don't talk about this and we see it as a forefront of just stats, but we
Yeah.
don't analyze them enough where we can move forward. And it's all about, okay, we have these stats, but how can we do better?
Yeah, and one thing I'd like to know is like how many of these female entrepreneurs are actually from California and from the
True.
Bay Area, because what I would like to see is more like women, and especially in the Bay Area, women of color and from different backgrounds being entrepreneurs. Like I would like us to be the number one in that
Yeah.
versus, a lot of other people moving in and settling in the Bay Area for the opportunities. Not that there's anything wrong with that. It's
We
just
love
that
y'all,
we love y'all, even though
but
you're contributing to gentrification. It's okay. What I would love to see is like those stats going up.
And I also want to recognize that just because we're high up there, we have so much more to go. Like, there's so much more space to grow and to develop. Because all the metropolitans, like including Bay Area and in New York, they're well below that 100 mark, and that's the total achievable score. So there's plenty of room for improvement. The index levels of 80 or 90 will be achieved if unconscious bias is achieved. So it's kind of like we're not even reaching the 80s or the 90s yet. So although this looks like a really cool news story to celebrate, and it is a news story that we should be celebrating, there's a lot of room we could be growing because there's so many factors that are still in place, and there's still a lot of boundaries and obstacles that women have to face to kind of even get up there.
Yeah, exactly. And not to mention like how many different sort of privileges or connections you need to have, and how that's easier based off of where you live, blah, blah, blah. Long story short is we still have a long way to go.
So I want to kind of point out like what are some ways that we kind of be more inclusive and diversify our workforce. And like there's obviously a debate for this, but why is it so important, and like how do we move forward? Because we are doing an okay job, but still, like, I think it was like four out of all the Fortune 500 companies, like only 5% are led by women.
Yeah,
that is puny. That's a small number.
And it's like, how many of those are white women, you know? So I think something that all workforces in all schools should do is like internal bias training. I think that's really important. And then I think every major corporation should work to hire a diverse staff, and diverse not just racially and gender diverse, but socioeconomic backgrounds and stuff like that. And I think that's something all companies should commit to and make an effort to do. Because I think what's happened in the past is there hasn't been that effort there. And so if everyone, and that's just not businesses, but schools and colleges, make that commitment, then the world will be a more diverse place.
I also want to point out, this can be a very long discussion. I wrote like a 14 paper, like crazy final paper on this that I can talk about. So if anybody wants to read my paper about the tech industry's problem with diversity, hit me up and I'll send it to you. But I wrote this paper based off of like the fact that there is a lot, or there is a lack of Black women within Silicon Valley. And so like I was reading stuff like, it's not just about the pipeline. The pipeline problem is always blamed. It's the first thing that people blame when it comes to diversity work. And it's because people are so used to the discussion of, oh, when you don't get an education, how are you going to expect
to... That's definitely deflecting.
Yeah, because there's so many people. There are stats and there are demographics and there are real studies that show that there are like Black women graduating from universities and graduating with the training and the right program, but they're not hired, they're not retaining the company. So obviously it's not a pipeline problem because they got that education. So it's like, why are they not accepted and why are they not included in these discussions? But it's also very important to realize that it's not just about hiring, it's also about retaining.
Yes.
Because you can hire all you want, but are these women going to stay in the workforce and are they going to be able to be promoted?
And go up to that 5%. Yeah, exactly. There was a familiar conversation about, like, has Hollywood changed since Harvey Weinstein or whatever? And, like, are there more female producers? And they say that there are more women at sort of the base level, but not yet at that high level. And that's what you want to see. That's how you achieve true diversity, is when you see it at all levels.
So, and I think it's also, like, very influential to notice that it's not just about educating, like, the Black women that need to come in, or educating any like anybody to come into the workforce. It's about educating the people that are already in those footsteps and in the company itself. So it's like, instead of educating the base level, you have to educate all the CEOs, you have to educate all the diversity and inclusion chairs, you have to educate the whole board, because those are the people making the decisions. And so if it's so easy to get people in the door, it's just, it needs to be just as easy to have the CEOs understand what it took to get in the door. This discussion can go on forever, but we will not let that go on forever because we don't have time.
Because Naomi has to go.
I have to go soon. But this is definitely like something I really want to talk about next time, or maybe we can do a separate episode. Maybe we should do some bonus episodes. Like nothing to do with history, just us talking about how our society's messed up and we need more women in our training.
Yes. I agree.
retweet. Anyway, so that basically concludes our episode. This is the fourth episode. Again, if you don't remember, because we've been babbling, we talked about reparations. We had a great discussion, but please let us know what you think and what you have to contribute.
Yes, and check out our Instagram, Pacific Atrocities EDU. Make sure to follow us on there. And please leave a review.
Please.
That really helps people find your podcast.
But thank you for all the support y'all have given us. We've been getting a lot of good reviews. We've got a lot of listening time. There's somebody listening from Japan and Colombia and Canada.
I hope they like this conversation.
Shout out to y'all. But we hope you enjoyed this episode of Boba Talk, and we can't wait to see you next time.
Yes, we can't wait. Bye.